Chapter 2. Over the hot grass of the binnacle top, suddenly he stood up with a jerk and said sharply in a hoarse voice, "You've been sleeping, you. Shift the helm. S.E. has got stern way on her." The Malay, without the least flinch of feature or pose, as if he had been an inanimate object called suddenly into life by some hidden magic of the words, spun the wheel rapidly, letting the spokes pass through his hands, and when the motion had stopped with a grinding noise, caught hold again, and held on grimly. After a while, however, he turned his head slowly over his shoulder, glanced at the sea, and said in an obstinate tone, "No catch, wind, no getaway. No catch, no catch, that's all you know about it," growled the red-faced seaman. "Be by and by catch, ally," he went on with sudden condescension. "Be by and by catch, and then the helm will be the right way. See?" The stolid sea caddy appeared to see, and for that matter to hear, nothing. The white man looked at the impassive Malay with disgust, then glanced around the horizon, then again at the helmsman and ordered curtly, "Shift the helm back again. Don't you feel the air from aft? You are like a dummy standing there." The Malay revolved the spokes again with disdainful obedience, and the red-faced man was moving forward grunting to himself, when through the open skylight the hail and deck there arrested him short, attentive, and with a sudden change to amiability in the expression of his face. "Yes, sir," he said, bending his ear toward the opening. "W, what's the matter up there?" asked a deep voice from below. The red-faced man in a tone of surprise said, "Sir, I hear that rudder grinding hard up and hard down. What are you up to, Shaw? Any wind?" "Yes," drawled Shaw, putting his head down the skylight and speaking into the gloom of the cabin. I thought there was a light air, and but it's gone now. Not a breath anywhere under the heavens." He withdrew his head, and waited a while by the skylight, but heard only the chirping of the indefatigable canary, a feeble twittering, that seemed to ooze through the drooping red blossoms of geraniums growing in flower pots under the glass panes. He strolled away a step or two before the voice from down below called hurriedly, "Hey, Shaw? Are you there?" "Yes, Captain Lingard," he answered, stepping back. "Have we drifted anything this afternoon?" "Not an inch, sir, not an inch. We might as well have been at anchor." "It's always so," said the invisible Lingard. His voice changed its tone as he moved in the cabin, and directly afterward burst out with a clear intonation, while his head appeared above the slide of the cabin entrance. "Always so. The currents don't begin till it's dark, when a man can't see against what confounded thing he is being drifted, and then the breeze will come. Dead on end too, I don't doubt." Shaw moved his shoulders slightly. The Malay at the wheel, after making a dive, to see the time by the cabin clock through the skylight, rang a double stroke on the small bell aft. Directly forward, on the main deck, a shrill whistle arose long-drawn, modulated, dying away softly. The master of the brig stepped out of the companion upon the deck of his vessel, glanced aloft at the yards laid dead square, then, from the doorstep, took a long, lingering look round the horizon. He was about 35, erect and supple. He moved freely, more like a man accustomed to stride over plains and hills, than like one who from his earliest youth had been used to counteract by sudden swayings of his body the rise and roll of cramped decks of small craft, tossed by the caprice of angrier playful seas. He wore a gray flannel shirt, and his white trousers were held by a blue silk scarf wound tightly round his narrow waist. He had come up only for a moment, but finding the poop shaded by the main topsail he remained on deck bareheaded. The light chestnut hair curled close about his well-shaped head, and the clipped beard glinted vividly when he passed across a narrow strip of sunlight, as if every hair in it had been a wavy and attenuated gold wire. His mouth was lost in the heavy mustache. His nose was straight, short, slightly blunted at the end. A broad band of deeper red stretched under the eyes, clung to the cheekbones. The eyes gave the face its remarkable expression. The eyebrows, darker than the hair, penciled a straight line below the wide and unwrinkled brow, much whiter than the sunburnt face. The eyes, as if glowing with the light of a hidden fire, had a red glint in their grayness that gave a scrutinizing ardor to the steadiness of their gaze. That man, once so well known, and now so completely forgotten amongst the charming and heartless shores of the shallow sea, had amongst his fellows the nickname of Red-Eyed Tom. He was proud of his luck, but not of his good sense. He was proud of his brig, of the speed of his craft, which was reckoned the swiftest country vessel in those seas, and proud of what she represented. She represented a run of luck on the Victorian goldfields. His sagacious moderation, long days of planning, of loving care in building, the great joy of his youth, the incomparable freedom of the seas, a perfect because a wandering home, his independence, his love and his anxiety. He had often heard men say that Tom Lingard cared for nothing on earth, but for his brig, and in his thoughts he would smilingly correct the statement by adding that he cared for nothing living but the brig. To him she was as full of life as the great world. He felt her live in every motion, in every roll, in every sway of her tapering masts, of those masts whose painted trucks move forever, to a seaman's eye, against the clouds, or against the stars. To him she was always precious like old love, always desirable like a strange woman, always tender like a mother, always faithful like the favorite daughter of a man's heart. For hours he would stand elbow on rail, his head in his hand, and listen in dreamy stillness to the cajoling and promising whisper of the sea, that slipped past in vanishing bubbles along the smooth black painted sides of his craft. What passed in such moments of thoughtful solitude through the mind of that child of generations of fishermen from the coast of Devon, who, like most of his class, was dead to the subtle voices, and blind to the mysterious aspects of the world, the man ready for the obvious, no matter how startling, how terrible or menacing, yet defenseless as a child before the shadowy impulses of his own heart. What could have been the thoughts of such a man, when once surrendered to a dreamy mood, it is difficult to say. No doubt he, like most of us, would be uplifted at times by the awakened lyrism of his heart in two regions charming, empty, and dangerous. But also, like most of us, he was unaware of his barren journeys above the interesting cares of this earth. Yet from these, no doubt absurd and wasted moments, there remained on the man's daily life a tinge as that of a glowing and serene half-light. It softened the outlines of his rugged nature, and these moments kept close the bond between him and his brig. He was aware that his little vessel could give him something not to be had from anybody or anything in the world, something specially his own. The dependence of that solid man of bone and muscle on that obedient thing of wood and iron, acquired from that feeling the mysterious dignity of love. She, the craft, had all the qualities of a living thing. Speed, obedience, trustworthiness, endurance, beauty, capacity to do, and to suffer all but life. He, the man, was the inspirer of that thing, that to him seemed the most perfect of its kind. His will was its will, his thought was its impulse, his breath was the breath of its existence. He felt all this confusedly, without ever shaping this feeling into the soundless formulas of thought. To him she was unique and dear, this brig of 314 tons register a kingdom. And now, bareheaded and burly, he walked the deck of his kingdom with a regular stride. He stepped out from the hip, swinging his arms with the free motion of a man starting out for a 15-mile walk into open country, yet at every 12th stride he had to turn about sharply and pace back the distance to the taffrail. Shaw, with his hand stuck in his waistband, had hooked himself with both elbows to the rail and gazed apparently at the deck between his feet. In reality he was contemplating a little house with a tiny front garden, lost in a maze of riverside streets in the East End of London. The circumstance that he had not, as yet, been able to make the acquaintance of his son now aged 18 months worried him slightly, and was the cause of that flight of his fancy into the murky atmosphere of his home. But it was a placid flight followed by a quick return. In less than 2 minutes he was back in the brig. All there, as his saying was. He was proud of being always LL there. He was abrupt in manner and grumpy in speech with the seamen. To his successive captains, he was outwardly as deferential as he knew how, and as a rule inwardly hostile, so very few seemed to him of the LL there kind. Of Lingard, with whom he had only been a short time having been picked up in Madras Roads out of a home ship, which he had to leave after a thumping row with the master he generally approved, although he recognized with regret that this man, like most others, had some absurd fads. He defined them as autumn upwards notions. He was a man as there were many of no particular value to anybody but himself, and of no account, but as the chief mate of the brig, and the only white man on board of her besides the captain. He felt himself immeasurably superior to the Malay seamen whom he had to handle, and treated them with lofty toleration, notwithstanding his opinion that at a pinch those chaps would be found emphatically out there. As soon as his mind came back from his home leave, he detached himself from the rail, and, walking forward, stood by the break of the poop, looking along the port side of the main deck. Lingard on his own side stopped in his walk, and also gazed absent-mindedly before him. In the waist of the brig, in the narrow spars that were lashed on each side of the hatchway, he could see a group of men squatting in a circle around a wooden tray piled up with rice, which stood on the just-swept deck. The dark-faced, soft-eyed silent men, squatting on their hams, fed decorously with an earnestness that did not exclude reserve. Of the lot, only one or two wore sarongs, the others having submitted at least at sea to the indignity of European trousers. Only two sat on the spars. One, a man with a childlike, light yellow face, smiling with fatuous imbecility under the wisps of straight coarse hair, dyed a mahogany tint, was the title of the crew a kind of boatswain's or sarang's mate. The other, sitting beside him on the booms, was a man nearly black, not much bigger than a large ape, and wearing on his wrinkled face that look of comical truculence which is often characteristic of men from the southwestern coast of Sumatra. This was the kassab or storekeeper, the holder of a position of dignity and ease. The kassab was the only one of the crew taking their evening meal who noticed the presence on deck of their commander. He muttered something to the Tyndall who directly cocked his old hat on one side, which senseless action invested him with an altogether foolish appearance. The others heard, but went on somnolently feeding with spidery movements of their lean arms. The sun was no more than a degree or so above the horizon, and from the heated surface of the waters a slight low mist began to rise, a mist thin, invisible to the human eye, yet strong enough to change the sun into a mere glowing red disk, a disk vertical and hot, rolling down to the edge of the horizontal and cold-looking disk of the shining sea. Then the edges touched and the circular expanse of water took on suddenly a tint, somber, like a frown, deep, like the brooding meditation of evil. The falling sun seemed to be arrested for a moment in his descent by the sleeping waters, while from it, to the motionless brig, shot out on the polished and dark surface of the sea a track of light, straight and shining, resplendent and direct, a path of gold and crimson and purple, a path that seemed to lead dazzling, unterrible from the earth straight into heaven through the portals of a glorious death. It faded slowly. The sea vanquished the light. At last only a vestige of the sun remained, far off, like a red spark floating on the water. It lingered, and all at once without warning, went out as if extinguished by a treacherous hand. "Gone," cried Lingard, who had watched intently yet missed the last moment. "Gee, gone. Look at the cabin clock, Shaw. Nearly right, I think, sir. 6:03. The helmsman struck four bells sharply. Another barefooted sea canny glided on the far side of the poop to relieve the wheel, and the sarang of the brig came up the ladder to take charge of the deck from Shaw. He came up to the compass and stood waiting silently. The course is south by east, when you get the wind, Sarang, said Shaw, distinctly. Sue by east, repeated the elderly Malay with grave earnestness. Let me know when she begins to steer, added Lingard. Yeah, Tuan, answered the man, glancing rapidly at the sky. W wind coming, he muttered. I think so too, whispered Lingard as if to himself. The shadows were gathering rapidly round the brig. A mulatto put his head out of the companion and called out. Ready, sir. Let's get a mouthful of something to eat, Shaw, said Lingard. I say, just take a look around before coming below. It will be dark when we come up again. Certainly, sir, said Shaw, taking up a long glass and putting it to his eyes. Be blessed thing, he went on in snatches, while he worked the tubes in and out. I can't never somehow, I've got it right at last. He revolved slowly on his heels, keeping the end of the tube on the skyline. Then he shut the instrument with a click, and said decisively, nothing in sight, sir. He followed his captain down below, rubbing his hands cheerfully. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.